Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Tour Shed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest, Professor Charles Lee. Professor Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you. A pleasure to be on the show.
Oh, well, honored to have you here. You've been busy working on a new book called Lord Guan, which I'm reading at the moment and enjoying very much. Historical fiction. I'm a big historical fiction fan. I've never read much of Chinese historical fiction. I've been reading a bit of Indian historical fiction at the moment, which is like a retelling of the Ramayana by Amish Tripathi. So this is really, really refreshing to pick up something like I've never read anything like before. So today we're going to talk all about it and how you wrote it and how what it was like bringing such an incredible historical figure to life. I'm sure there's a lot of pressure because Lord Guan was such a revered character, I suppose, is he?
Yeah. No, it wasn't a stressful undertaking, and I wrote two sort of memoirs, and it was a very different undertaking, and it was interesting. And the only reason I got into it is through the urging of Judith Regan, who has been in the publishing world for a long time. But then I thought that, but I've always been interested in writing. Ever since I was a teenager, but of course at that time I was writing mostly in Chinese. It was a way for me to earn a little money. I don't want to give the impression that I was making any money, but I was earning, you know, a couple dollars for a short essay, for a lyrical piece or whatever in student magazines and publications, and but that was very refreshing, and that was important, and I enjoyed the process of writing. And then I met Judith Regan, and we became friends, and I talked a lot, and so I was always telling stories. So she said that you're a great storyteller and you have great stories, so you should write it up. But in the Chinese culture, it where I grew up, I didn't come to the United States until I was 21 years old. So we think that writing a memoir of yourself is kind of peddling yourself. Not something very that inspire respect. And I was very reluctant to do that. But in the end, when I retired from my teaching career, so I was overseas for a year, and I didn't want to keep on doing academic research. So I said, oh, why not? I like writing. I like sitting there, you know, cogitating and thinking about plots and telling stories. So I wrote it, and that's how I began. And after that, I sort of get somewhat addicted to writing and reading and so on. And I wanted to do something more than just writing memoirs. So I thought I took on a historical novel because I like that particular genre, and lots of material for historical novels in Chinese history, of course. So anyway, and so that's how it happened.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic story. And you've got a really incredible life story as well. So you mentioned there that you left China at the age of 21. What was that like? Did that have much of an influence on your writing? Did it, I mean, it sounds like you've had a bit of a gap from when you started writing as a teenager, and then you come sort of full circle to historical fiction. So what was it like for you sort of transitioning and all the change in your life?
Well, I came here so by accident, and because in 1961 I was there was a I think it was called International Refugee Year, and United States government offered six fellowships for people from East Asia, for young people, who anyone who had a high school degree, a high school graduation, who was a high school graduation, was eligible to apply. And I was living in Hong Kong then, so my friend heard about it, and he wanted to take part in the application, and urged me to do so. And I said, nah. But anyway, I was trying to eke out a living in Hong Kong, and life was hard. And he was a good friend, and so in the end, I relented and agreed with him to just to keep him company. And there were, I don't know, hundreds and maybe thousands of applicants, and everyone wanted to get the hell out of Hong Kong. In those days, it was that British colony, a full old-fashioned British colony, where the Brits treat the Chinese as dogs, and with signs, even in the public, in certain area where the Brits live, and they would put up signs. I know that you are British, but this is
I don't identify as British. I
that's
identify
okay.
as Irish. But
Okay.
like it's like it's not something that gets spoken about over here, and I would love here to tell more about it, because like Irish people, for example, I mean they're heavily sort of persecuted by the British throughout history.
Yeah.
There's signs used to put up in London saying, "What is it? No blacks, no Irish, no dogs."
Yeah.
So what was it like? I mean, it must have been really, really horrific. Like, did you grow up in Hong Kong as well?
No, I spent my no, I grew up in China proper, and lived in different cities in the 40s, in the 1940s, and 50s.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In 1951 is when I went to Hong Kong. I sort of had a broken family, so life was not very easy for me, particularly in a in an underdeveloped countries in those days. But in a colony, it's particularly repressive and unforgiving, let's say. Okay, and so anyway, so I was very fortunate to be chosen, and for a scholarship to come to this country to experiment, ex to have the experience of a college education for 1 year only. And I was put into a particular college. There were six of us, each was put into a different college, and mostly liberal arts college, not too big. And but anyway, so I came, and it was a traumatic experience, because it was at that time in the United States, 1961 was basically 1950 atmosphere. People were not aware of racism. There was a beginning it was the beginning of some feeling about blacks and so on in this country at that time among the more enlightened or educated people. But generally, it was a pretty racist place anyway. And I was on the East Coast in New England, and it was not very nice. And I thought, gee, contrary to my imagination, which was that United States was sort of a paradise, it was like hell. And I wanted to get the hell out of there as soon as I get a degree. So I worked very hard and got a degree in 2 years. But of course, I was in mathematics. And in those days, in my days, when I grew up in China and in Hong Kong, any young person who had any pride, who wanted to be known as not stupid and not retarded, and would major in science and technology or you know. So anyway, I was reasonably good at mathematics, and so I majored in math and graduated in 2 years, and then I went to a PhD program in mathematics at Stanford, and that's where I began to really sort of learn about Western civilizations in terms of culture, history, literature, and it was very exciting, but it was also very traumatic without my being aware of it. I just knew that I was very tense, and I had a good group of international friends from all different places. Some were graduate students, some were beginning faculty members, and and they sort of gave me a different kind of education, and I was always trying to read and learn to keep up with them because they talked about things I knew nothing about. Because that sort of that period of time sort of really broadened my horizon, and I was no longer sort of preoccupied or obsessed with survival, with physical survival. And that was the, you know, prior to that, my life was physical survival. How do you, you know, how am I going to get my next meal? What am I going
to
sleep
with? To do that, aren't you? Like, you just, it becomes instinctive to feel like that.
Yeah. And, but they had sort of, my friends, meaning, had sort of, and knowingly, without any conscious effort, sort of guided me into a different mental framework. And so I quit my PhD program in math and went into linguistics. I remember running into some of my old high school classmates. Most of them came to the United States, classmates from Hong Kong. And they found out that I had left mathematics and went into linguistics. And the first thing they asked me is that, what went wrong with you? Are you okay?
I can relate to that. I was a lawyer and I quit that to be a writer.
Right. I learned about that. No,
and
right.
People were asking me, is everything all right? What's wrong with you? Like, but if you don't love something, I mean, I don't know if you felt like this as well. Like, you could see the life before you.
Yeah.
When you
yeah.
were doing your PhD and you just weren't happy and you could see no happiness.
Right. Right. And I was just, you know, really interested in different cultures and, I mean, quote unquote, exotic cultures. So I worked on American Indian languages. I worked on Papuan languages in Papua New Guinea and did field work in Inner Asia and so on. And that's how I, you know, I had sort of,
that sounds really amazing. I mean, have you, just out of interest, have you got a favorite language that you've come across or a favorite way of communication?
I would say it is English.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an exceptionally rich language because it sort of incorporates elements from all sort of languages. I mean, it's hardly any any family of language from which English has not borrowed concepts or words, you know, and it has all these different ways of expressing things. I mean, not that you cannot say that one language is more expressive than another. I mean, all languages are equally facilitative in terms of expressing your experience, emotions, and so on. But the enormous way of saying things and enormous vocabulary, incorporating concepts from all different cultures, from Malayo-Polynesian to, you know, to Indian to Africa to everything you can imagine. And I think English is just a fantastic language.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, we get a lot of questions because a lot of the listeners, fantasy.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Fans. So a big part of that is having to create your own worlds.
Yeah.
And if you're a fan of Lords of the Rings, obviously you may be familiar. Tolkien created the
Right.
Elvish language.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if someone listening wanted to create their own sort of language, what would you sort of advice would you give them in terms of like creating like the foundations and the sort of the key aspects of it?
Yeah, you cannot really a language is really inseparable from culture. So you can create a language. I mean, there have been different languages created in the last 50 years, including one of my fellow classmate who made a good living by creating the language in that movie. What's that movie? There was a movie about an exotic people
Avatar?
living. That's it.
Avatar?
That's right.
Avatar,
That's
yeah.
Avatar. That's right.
That's
That's right.
impressive that he created that language. Amazing.
Yeah,
Or that
exactly.
good teacher.
His specialty was California Indian languages, most of which have died off. I worked on one last ones that were survived only in one person, and so I became known as the other speaker of this particular California Indian language called WaPo. Anyway, so California Indian languages are very diverse. There were more languages, distinct languages, mutually unintelligible languages in California than in the whole United States in the old days,
Oh.
when the American Indian languages had not gone kaput. You know, I mean,
Yeah.
almost all California Indian languages are dead now.
So
Yeah, I
sad.
can't think of anyone that's anything. I mean, the largest group was Chumash. Chumash is in the area where I am, in the Santa Barbara area. So words like Malibu, for example, is a Chumash word, which means a beach. And you know, so Malibu is a very fancy community on the coast, on the beach, south of north of LA, between LA and Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And but anyway, so he was an American, he was a California Indian language person, and so it really wasn't very hard. Wasn't I don't think it's very difficult to make up a language, if you just know enough distinct, very unrelated languages in the world. But I think he did a good job. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
So, you came to write Lord Guan, and it's not a story I'm familiar with, and he's not a figure I'm familiar with, but the is a good chance that we've seen pictures of him. probably, and I understand that you see pictures of him in like restaurants and businesses and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah,
But
I
he's probably like one of in like you I think you mentioned before, like the West has probably not really heard of him. And it sounds like it's such a significant figure in Chinese culture that it's a
Yeah.
bit of a crime that we don't know.
I know, I know.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us a bit about the history and then the story?
Yeah, well, it's mostly he became known in China and became important and became an icon and a god and an object of worship, a religious religious figure in the sense of a religion revolving around him after he died. Okay, so when he was alive, he was a warrior, and he was not a prominent man, but his sworn brother and close associate were trying to vie for dominance in China in the 3rd century after the Han Dynasty, which was sort of the foundational dynasty of Chinese history, began to disintegrate. But after he died, he became ever more. I mean, his reputation started growing and expanding, and he was deified by public acclaim. He was deified by different emperors at different time and invoked by different leaders at time of need, because they wanted to show the people that Lord Guan was on he on their side. And so it became a religion, really. And almost every communities would have shrines and small temples devoted to him. Buddhism was incorporated him into their pantheon of gods, and Taoism also included him as a very important god in their religious framework. So he sort of was everywhere in China, and everyone knew about him. Unlike Confucius, who was more of a figure to be revered, more of a man who set down the philosophical foundations of the Chinese culture, whereas he was a popular hero, was a popular man who was known for his courage, for his integrity, for his abiding loyalty. And so people started praying to him and become supplicants to him for anything, like, please help me to have a son. A common in the old days, a common wish for many women, or please help me to pass the next stage of the examination so that I can advance in my career, whatever, and everywhere. So they were so Lord Guan was in the heart and in the mind and in the life of all people, much more so than Confucius was. Confucius set the philosophical foundations for the country, set the moral standards for the country, but he was kind of a remote figure. I mean, no one felt really connected to him in any way. He was revered, but whereas Lord Guan was someone that you felt close to, that you want to be on your side, that you want him to be to fulfill your wishes and so on. So he was really important in Chinese culture. Yeah.
What is it about him, do you think, that people found so appealing? And because I've been the first few chapters that I've read, he comes across as he's like a normal figure. His family are quite normal, they're just farmers.
Yeah.
And is do you think it's that relatability factor that he's just a normal person?
Well, these are in the first few chapters, it's all made up by it's all my imagination. There was not much, okay, not much known about him until he became a incredibly successful warrior, a great a fighter. Okay,
yeah,
and not became sort of, and he didn't become a universal cultural hero and icon until after he died. So as much as the Chinese love to keep written records about everything, you can't keep written records of every single person, you know. So not much is known about him. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to pick on him to write this historical novel, because then I can also let my imagination fly, you know, and make up stories. And I mean, we knew he came from a humble origin. That's all we know in terms of historical record. The only real historical record that we have was from a celebrated Chinese historical novel called The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, in which he was he played a prominent role because of his capability as a great dominating warrior. And so all that story is about him growing up in a village and killing someone by hand, and it's all my imagination.
I suppose, like, you could base it on, like, the average life of people from humble beginnings in China, and it's really interesting. I mean, it's so tough. It's like really like a, like you described before in Hong Kong, like a fight for survival. Like, it's the same. It's the same, wasn't it? Like, if they, for farmers back then, if one thing went wrong, it was pretty tough for them, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, in the 1940s, I sort of experienced and saw quite a bit of that kind of life, you know, and in rural China, and the poverty, the oppression, and the suffering of the peasants, and so I witnessed some of that in the 1940s. Well, particularly during the Civil War, when the communists was fighting against the nationalists before the communists came into power. And of course, once the communists came into power, Lord Guan began to recede from the public life because the communists were against any religion in 1949. So he was so the tens of thousands of temples and shrines all across the country were demolished by the communists. But surprisingly,
did you agree with that, or did you sort of, was that quite upsetting?
Well,
thing?
It was just a fact of life. I mean, you know, that was Mao's edict, and that was an edict that's supported by Mao's cohorts, and you know, there was life in China. I mean, all religions suffered, right? I mean, we nowadays we hear about things like the persecution of the Uyghurs. We hear about the persecution of the Tibetans, and that's partly racism because they were not Han Chinese. Han Chinese meaning the dominant ethnic group in China. Dominant and overwhelmingly dominant in terms of numbers and all of that. Out of the 1 billion, 1.3 billion Chinese, I would say it's something like 1.2 billion are, let me see. Now, I know that number pretty well because I worked on Chinese minorities for a long time, languages and all of that. I would say, somewhere between 1.1 out of 1.3 billion Chinese population, I would say around 1.1 billion are Han ethnic people. And there's a lot of racism against the minorities. I mean, the minorities that we hear that in the West you hear about are, you know, now the Turkic people, the Uyghur, which belong to the Turkic group, and the Tibetans. which belonged to the Tibetan Burma group. And but there were hundreds of other, I mean, Mongols, you hear Mongols, you know, and of course, Mongols have ruled China, but so did most other minorities have ruled China. In fact, over the dynastic era, there were more dynasties that were established by non-Han Chinese than there were dynasties established by Han Chinese. But of course, the reason people always ask me when I say that, it says, why is that so? Wouldn't you know, the dominant population, wouldn't they always sort of take over the power, and if they discriminate against the minorities, and they would be the boss? Well, the thing is that in the old days, in order to establish a dynasty, first of all, you have to have a period of anarchy. In other words, an existing dynasty is in decline, falling apart, and law and order disappears, and bandits everywhere. Now, in order to become dominant and powerful, you have to have a group that are great fighters, right?
Yeah.
But most of those minorities were tremendous fighters because they grew up on different diet. The Chinese were a sedentary agricultural people for eons of time, you know, for more than 10,000 years now, okay, 9,000 years in the plains of Great Plains of East Asia.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
But the other minorities are mostly nomads. They are pastoralists. Well, what do nomads eat when they grow up? They eat, they drink milk, and they eat meat. No, what do the Chinese in the old days, they eat? The little kids, what do they eat? All the adults. They eat bread, or they eat rice.
Yeah.
So you're not going to grow up to be a powerful figure if you grow up eating rice or wheat most of the time. I mean, without, whereas if you grow up on a diet of rich protein, then you are more likely to fulfill your genetic potentials for size and strength. So yeah. That's why the founders of dynasties were typically either non-Han Chinese or at least half non-Han Chinese. For example, you take a dynasty like the Tang Dynasty. You might have heard of, that's considered sort of it went from the beginning of the 7th century until the 10th century, lasted 300 some years. It was considered the golden age, like the 17th century in Holland. You know, it was the golden age of Holland. That's the Tang Dynasty was considered the golden age of the Chinese dynastic era. The founder was half nomad. They were his father was a military person stationed in the borderland of Western China, and he married a different minority woman who were nomads, and that's how the son grew up, and mostly under the influence of his mother, who happened to be a very powerful woman. And then when he started a revolution against the existing dynasty, he mostly drew help at the very beginning from all his mother's tribes in the Taklamakan Desert in Central Asia and all of that. So that's why the founding the founders of dynasty were often not Han Chinese, But
It
the
makes
thing,
sense though, doesn't it? Because
I
if you've
know.
got minorities living there and you've got someone who's half Han, half minority, then it's a unifying figure. It's someone who can bring everybody in.
Right, exactly. But the
So
thing is
it's
that,
not surprising it's a golden age.
yeah, but the thing is that once what the people who wrote history of China, see, for example, there's a long practice that every dynasty, once it's been founded, once it has become established, then its first priority, it is the duty of that dynasty, of that emperor and his court, to write a history of the dynasty that preceded it.
Yeah.
But who was the writers? Of course, they were the Chinese. They were the Han Chinese. So how did
Yeah.
they So when the Han Chinese write a history of the previous dynasty, so they were trying to sinnify the founders and the other emperors as much as possible.
So do you think this is what happened with Lord Guan?
Well, who was Lord Guan? Now, of course, everyone thinks of Lord Guan as Han Chinese, but on the other hand, physically he was enormous. He was incredibly strong and powerful, and coming from a poor background, so that would be very unusual. And secondly, he was known to have to be very hairy, and he's, you know, he has a huge beard.
Yeah.
When a Han Chinese have a beard, it's typically very thin and sort of whiskers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Ho Chi Minh beard, that's a typical like Chinese.
Yeah.
And not Lord Guan. He had a whole face full of hair, and come he his nickname, as I said in the book, was the Magnificent Beard. And he was, of course, physically incredibly strong and powerful, and he had dark skin. So who knows what his original ethnicity? Nobody knows. But of course, the Chinese, all of the Chinese who wrote about him would say that he was Han Chinese.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's typical, you know, in the even in the last dynasty, which is the Manchu dynasty that got toppled in 1911 by Sun Yat-sen, they were, you know, they were Manchus. They were in their court, in the court, in the imperial court, until the very end in the imperial court. When military affairs were discussed, it was discussed only in Manchu, not in Chinese.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, but of course, if you look at Chinese history, you read about Chinese history, that's a Chinese dynasty, the last dynasty of the dynastic era. And yes, the founders were Manchus, but they all become Sinicized. But well, you know, that's really not true. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was it about Luo Guan then that, I mean, like what did he do in his life that really made
Well,
him this eternal figure?
so the historical information about him were mostly from a book called The Romance of the Three Kingdoms. That was the first historical novel published written in China in the 14th century. No, 14th, yeah, more like 15th century. And so he was celebrated for his physical prowess, for his warrior capability, and he wielded a scabbard, and he was sort of peerless, and he was a game changer when they come to a battlefield. Once he come into the battle, and all of his soldiers will get all excited and charged up, and the enemies were just scared. Just seeing him was this big, huge man wearing a huge scabbard and dark face with an enormous beard, and so he was a game changer. And he
He almost
dedicated
sounds a bit like a Viking, doesn't he?
Oh, that's right. The North, yeah, the Vikings who came into Europe at different periods of time. And you know, the Vikings, in fact, the Normans were actually Even in Sicily, you know, was partly conquered by the Norman, by the Viking people of Viking origin. Exactly, it's like an
I mean,
like a.
because the Vikings, they were in sort of the Ruhr, wasn't it? That's like the Ukraine, Kyiv, like that's where they were as well. I mean, it's not too far away from China. Could there have been sort of nomads that have come down? And is that like a possible link? Because literally from the way you describe, I mean, I'm just imagining imagining running into battle and it sounds like a Viking.
Yeah, of course there's no there would be no record of that, but the recorded link, of course, was the Empire of the Golden Horde in Ukraine long before Russia existed in the 15th century, 14th century. One of Genghis Khan's grandson, Batu, went there and established the Empire of the Golden Horde. So that was officially recorded, and we know all about that long before Moscow existed. So he, in fact, he was chosen by his clan to become the great Khan, one of the become a successor of Genghis Khan, and he refused. He turned it down because he was in such paradise in the plains of Ukraine, and it was such a rich country. He didn't want to go back to Mongolia to become the great Khan. Yeah,
I'd say it's a tough job.
right. So.
So Lord Gwan, be very sort of famous on the battlefield. And was there anything else that he was well known for that you've
He
sort of
was
written
famous
about in the book?
for his loyalty and for his courage, for his honesty. So he that's those are the qualities that he and he sort of personified in the Chinese mind. Honesty, courage, loyalty, and I guess physical dominance. He was deified for those reasons. But later on, you know, in the dynastic era, when he became so sort of omnipresent in the Chinese culture, so he got deified into everything you can imagine, including he was the god of wealth. That's why you, in the Western world, the only place where you often see his image and his little shrine was in Chinese shops in Chinatown. Because the last deification by popular acclaim was the god of wealth.
Interesting.
So, but most, as I wrote in the introduction, most Westerners who went to Chinese restaurants in Chinatown, in the Western countries, and see the shrine, little shrine next to the cash register, or the cashiers, mistook them, just assumed that that was had something to do with ancestor worship, but actually it's not. It's actually Lord Guan.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to keep an eye out now next time you go for Chinese.
Right, you'll see
Yeah.
that. There's the you if you take a careful look at those little the picture or the little shrine, you will see that the man has incredibly long, huge beard,
Yeah.
and dark red face, which was not typical East Asian, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Amazing.
he was, but he was also, very important in the culture in Korea, in Japan, in Vietnam, you know, so all over East Asia.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so what was it like writing that character then and bringing him to life? Was it a tough challenge or did you enjoy it? What was it a long process? Can you tell us a bit about
Oh, it
the
wasn't
writing?
long at all. It took me about a year and a half, less than 2 years to write it, and it was fun. I really enjoyed it tremendously, much more so than I did when I wrote those two memoirs of mine. It was I only the research came into relevance only after only when I sort of toward the end of the book, when I started describing the different battles that he was involved in.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the second half of the book began with his future wife, you know, and that was all my imagination. Nobody knew anything about his wife. Well, we don't know anything about his wife. There's no record of it. Well, in the Chinese culture, you know, a wife is not important.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
Right, right. So that was just all my imagination, and I made her to be a concubine of the imperial concubine who was forced to become a concubine and who hated it and escaped the palace, the imperial palace, and you know, so it was fun. It was fun because I could indulge in fantasies on my own.
Yeah, definitely. So that's all the more fitting that you're on the Fantasy Writers Tour shows. Because historical fiction, there is a lot, like you say, you've got a framework, but there's a lot of that you have to fill in yourself.
Exactly.
And there's a real skill to doing that. And the chapters that I've read so far, I've really, really enjoyed. And there's some very interesting characters, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I'm glad you did.
And yeah, so it's I do recommend everyone go and check it out. Click the link in the description to go and find it out. But one last question I've got for you, Professor Lee, is did you find any challenges, or did you run into any challenges when you were writing it, and how did you overcome it?
Did I find it challenging? No, I didn't find
any,
it.
Like, particular aspect of the writing that you found difficult?
No, not really. No, I just every day I just sit on my computer and write a couple hours. But you know, as you know, since you yourself is such a successful writer, a lot of the writing, most of the writing, is revision and rewriting and all of that. And I would think that the challenge there is really a challenge on patience, you know. Like, I mean, at some point I just say, no, I don't want to look at what, you know, I don't want to read what I just wrote last month.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
I have to read it again. I mean, the thing is that you can always improve. You know what I mean? The thing is that this revision process is endless. You can always improve many, many things: the storyline, the narrative, the vocabulary, the expressions, even the construction of a particular sentence and the description of a particular figure. There's always room to improve. So that's the It takes discipline to not give up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a fantastic bit of advice.
Otherwise, it's not. Otherwise, I just sort of sit on the computer and start typing it out. That's probably because I'm basically a very impatient person. So. It's a trial. It's very trying in terms of patience. I knew that this is far from ideal. What I've written. Let's say, suppose I wrote 2-3 pages yesterday, and this morning I opened up the computer and I saw the 3 pages. I can see, oh my God, did I do that? And so I start changing it, revising it, The next day, I will ask myself, and then I will write a few more pages, and the next day I'll ask myself, well, should I go back and look at the, you know, 10 pages back, or should I just only look at the last few pages I wrote? And the desire is to say, the hell with the pages that I wrote earlier and just move on and revise the part that I wrote yesterday. But that's the most difficult thing.
Yeah. It's definitely a patient man's game, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, when I learned about the, for example, Virginia Woolf, that she just sat there and she spent very little time writing now and then. And when she wrote, she just wrote them out. And that's just the way it was. And it's perfect. that's just amazing, you know.
It is, yeah. It's a real skill. But like you say, you've got to sit there. You've got to type. You've got to crack on. But I'm like you. Like I always get caught into the trap of going back. So now I'm not allowed to go back. I can only go forwards until I edit. So that's the rule.
You don't go back. I see. You don't go until, back and finish the whole thing.
Until I finish the draft.
Oh, really? Okay.
I can go back and make notes.
Ah.
But I'm not allowed to go back and change.
I see.
Unless it's something horrendously wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but, yeah.
Right. I think in the end, the revision that you engage in after you finish a draft of the book is more important than the revision that you do every day. But the thing is that even there, when you revise the whole manuscript, there is a need to keep on going. And it, as I said, it's an endless process. And so it's the difficulty that I feel is in fighting my own impatience to say, oh, the hell with it. That's it. I'm not going to go back anymore. But I really have to go back because there's all these inadequacies and mistakes and poor writing and so on. So finally, in the end, you know, you just kind of stop. But it's an endless process.
Yeah, it is. Continuous learning.
Right.
Are you going to write a second book then? Have you got a second book in the pipeline?
Well, I have. I don't know. I have. I'm ambivalent about that. On the one hand, I have lots of material. I want to write a book about this woman Wu Zetian was second century. She was a concubine in the imperial palace, but she was very unusual for many reasons. One is that while she was a concubine to the emperor, a favorite concubine yet, and she started carrying on with the crown prince. An affair. Well, I mean, you have to remember the emperor at that time was already old, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So,
like a standard.
Right. So the fact that she just, even that alone is sort of like incredibly daring, because if you're caught, you know, that would be gruesome death. You'll be garroted and who knows, whatever, you know, punishment.
A good romance story.
You know.
Be a best-selling romance novel with that one.
Right. But anyway, then then her husband, the emperor, died. And so the crown prince, her lover, ascended the throne. And the crown prince wanted to marry her and make her to be the empress. So the entire court, all the Mandarin officials, went up in arms because by official generational etiquette, this woman was his mother.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's like, I mean, she's not his biological mother, but she was a woman that belonged to her father. To his father, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He couldn't possibly marry a woman that belonged to his father. And that's completely turning upside down the Confucian ethical principle. So this woman, so the concubine responded to the court, to the Mandarin's officials. She says, very simple, I see your point. Okay, so I am, she said, I am now going into a monastery and I'm going to become a nun in the monastery. And 3 months later, I will be reincarnated into a different person. Then I come out, then I will marry, you know, the current emperor. So that sort of dispelled the whole problem of violating the fundamental principle of ethics in the Confucian philosophy. Yeah. Right? So anyway, so the court, the Mandarin's officials had no object, cannot think of way to object to her proposal. So she went to a nunnery and she became a Buddhist nun for 3 months and she came out. Anyway, so she married the crown prince. And then after some years, a few years, I think it was less than 10 years, and she had two sons with the emperor, who was madly in love with her, okay? And one of the sons, the older son, of course, became the crown prince. And her fascination with the emperor began to sort of vanish. She was getting older. She was more into other things, power and control. And so this is not officially established, but there's strong suspicion and strong circumstantial reasons to believe that she poisoned her husband, the emperor.
Yeah.
Okay. And at which point her first son would ascend the throne to become the next emperor, right? Mm. So she conveniently have her exiled. She got her private accolade to take the son into exile into the Taklamakan Desert in an oasis in a little kingdom. And so she was in charge and then she was the Empress Dowager in charge of the whole government and the whole court. And she turned out to be a very wise ruler and very powerful person. And she expanded the territories of China. She made the country to be prosperous. She was, she used very intelligent people to work for her. And so she was a sagacious ruler for something like 10, 15 years. And the country really prospered and people's life improved in many different ways. And the territory of China expanded westward and all of that. And of course, the Chinese historian, who were all Confucian Mandarins, never forgave her. And in fact, at some point during the 15 years when she was reigning, she said, "The hell with all of this, Confucian thing. So I'm in charge. I am going to be the emperor, even though I'm a woman, and I'm going to have a different dynasty." So she even did that, you know.
Okay.
And, so anyway, what, so.
What was she called? I didn't catch her name.
Called Wu Zetian. Wu.
Wu.
Empress Wu, yeah.
Empress Wu, nice. I think you need to write that story.
She killed her second son.
Oh, she's very determined, let's say that.
Because she arranged to have her first son, the crown prince, put into exile without public knowledge. So nobody knew where the the first son was when her husband died, and so the popular demand was that the younger son should now ascend the throne, which she didn't expect. You know what I mean? She wasn't in her plot. And so when that demand came into become stronger and stronger, she just had her second son killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was really an exceptional woman in many, many ways, particularly given the time and the context, right?
She sounds like amazingly significant in Chinese history.
Right.
Like what she achieved and the lengths she went to achieve them. It's incredible.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Keep us posted. You have to come back on and tell us about the story when you've written it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Occasionally.
So Professor Lee, yes, thank you very much. It's been wonderful talking with you and learning so much about Chinese history and your writing process as well, which is amazing. And we learned an awful lot about linguistics and creating languages, and that was extremely interesting as well. So thank you very much. It's been fantastic.
Thank you for interviewing me. Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading some of your short stories.
Oh, amazing. Thank you. I'll share some with you after this.
All right.
If we want to learn more about you and your writing, where is the best place to go?
My publisher is really after me. I have no websites. I don't belong to, I don't subscribe to any of the, whatever you call it, social media things.
That's
what about that. In fact, is tied in all of the writing more, publishing more. I feel bad for the publisher because they're not making money off of me.
Right? Do well, because, I'm sure.
Yeah, because if I'm not doing all of these things, then it's not very helpful. I'm just very bad at it. But now I have acceded to the publisher's pleading, and I am sort of trying to hire some person to manage social media presence, and I will have a social media presence, I hope, in a short time, and so we can sort of get in touch in that way.
Yeah, amazing. And of course, there'll be links to buy the books in the description, and you can follow on Amazon as well, I understand, and on Goodreads as well. So more books on the horizon, you'll be able to get notifications about them and follow news posts, like new social media accounts and stuff. So yeah,
okay.
Follow the links in the description. And Professor Lee, thank you very much again.
Okay, it was nice talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. If you'd like to join our writing community on Discord and get access to fantasy writing classes and books on Patreon, check the links in the description. And if you don't want to miss any future episodes, be sure to follow or subscribe. And to support the show, leave a quick rating on Spotify or iTunes and share this episode on social media or with anyone who you think may be interested. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the show.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.